This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning. We usually start by just sharing our names so that we all know who's here with us this morning. So we'll just kind of go around the room here. Those of you who are online, we can see your names online, but we don't see the names here in the room. So I'm Dan.
I'm Hogan.
Ben.
Todd.
Chuck.
Jim.
Jeffrey.
Bill.
Doug?
Hanukkah? Shanet? Welcome. Those of you who are joining us online, if you wouldn't mind turning on your camera, it's just nice to see the faces of the people that are attending our talk. I really appreciate everyone joining, both here at the temple and wherever else you might be. I'm going to leave my mask on for the talk. I hope everyone can hear and understand me okay. We're all sort of feeling our way through this current surge, trying to balance our desire to get back to something close to our normal routines, and also wanting to keep ourselves and everyone around us safe. I really do appreciate those of you who came out in person, and really appreciate those of you who are joining us online. It's a little difficult to know how to negotiate this current situation, and yeah, we're all doing our best. Doug mentioned in our service today, we dedicated our service to the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, who passed away a couple days ago. Great Vietnamese Zen master. He was 95 years old, and he was living at Tu Phu, where he was first ordained. I think just a small ordinary monastery in Vietnam. As far as I know, it was not anywhere that was particularly famous or renowned. And he lived there as a young boy. It's where he was first ordained. And then had been living there again since 2018. He suffered a stroke some years ago, and he was not well. But his students suggested that he was still very happy to be back at his home temple, to be practicing again at the place where he first did his Zen training. I met Thich Nhat Hanh a few times during his life. In the 90s, he used to come reasonably often to the Bay Area. I met him, I think, once in Oakland, where he led a walking meditation around Lake Merritt. Mm-hmm. And then, very strange, but in the early, I guess, mid-2000s, when I worked at Google, he came there and I think spent almost like a whole day leading a practice. I have very fond memories of practicing with him at that very unlikely makeshift meditation hall that he created in the cafeteria. And I read his book, The Miracle of Mindfulness, during the very first session that I sat. I was still in college, and I went to the Zen Center of Los Angeles and sat a session with Meizumi Roshi there. And someone had given me a copy of The Miracle of Mindfulness before I left. And so during breaks that week, I was reading through that book. Thich Nhat Hanh started his life as a very traditional Zen student, practicing probably much like we've been practicing here this morning. Training as a monk, learning all the rituals and chants, and in some ways living a fairly conventional monastic life, as monks and nuns have been leading since the Buddha's time, 2,500 years ago. But in some ways, there was no way to lead a conventional life in Vietnam in those days. The country had been at war more or less continuously since the 50s and the end of the French occupation. And Thich Nhat Hanh began advocating what came to be called engaged Buddhism, that the monks should not just focus on temple life, but should be engaged with the wider world and the controversies of the time. He wasn't partisan. He didn't take sides in the various conflicts going on in Vietnam. But he felt it was his place to advocate for peace, for reconciliation, for some alternative to the near constant fighting. And I think even in Vietnam in those days, he was not particularly famous. This would have been in the late 50s and early 60s. He was not a celebrity. He was one of many Vietnamese Buddhist monks trying to find some way of ending this conflict. He came to the US first as a student, and then as a lecturer. And then at one point, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a religious peace organization here in America, invited him to kind of take a tour. And not to teach Buddhism, but to talk about his work advocating for peace. This was in 1966. Buddhism in some ways was starting to be more well established. There, of course, had long been Buddhist practitioners within the Asian American community, going back certainly until the 1800s. But a generation of teachers, and particularly a generation of Japanese teachers, had come and begun teaching Buddhism and meditation to non-Asian students. But this first generation of teachers, Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco, Meizumi Roshi in Los Angeles, our own founding teacher, Kobunchino Urugawa Roshi, they didn't talk about politics very much. You know, probably the most famous collection of Zen talks from that time, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, has hardly a word of anything that you could call political, despite the fact that those talks were given, almost all of them, between 1965 and 1967, a very political time. The same time, really, that Thich Nhat Hanh was here on an explicitly political mission. It said that Suzuki Roshi students talked to him a bit about the Vietnam War and war in general. And there was a sense that he had been opposed to the militarism in Japan around World War II, but he never really protested that war publicly, because to do so would have been very dangerous. But of course, it was dangerous for Thich Nhat Hanh too. He risked arrest or worse. And in the end, in the middle of his lecture tour here in America, there was a coup in Vietnam. And it was clear that because of his political commitment to pacifism, he couldn't go back. And so what had been intended as a short visit to the West became over 50 years of living in exile. The first book that he published in the West was called Vietnam, Lotus in a Sea of Fire. And it's very interesting. I found a copy once in the basement of some friends of my parents. And it gives a history of Vietnamese Buddhism and talks a little bit about how Buddhism came to Vietnam. But it's not a book about practice at all. There's very little mention of meditation. It really just tries to set the historical context for his peace advocacy. When the Paris peace talks began, trying to find an end to the war in Vietnam, Thich Nhat Hanh moved to Paris to take part. And there was a small group of volunteers that kind of helped him out. And he started teaching meditation to these volunteers just because they asked him to. I think in some ways he still didn't really think of himself as a meditation teacher primarily. But after these peace talks, this little community that had kind of sprung up around him bought an old farmhouse in rural France and started a small publishing operation. One of the Americans who visited said that they were using old yogurt jars as glue pots and toothbrushes to apply the glue for binding the books. Thich Nhat Hanh had written poetry in Vietnam, and so some of these first books were books of poetry. But one of them that they published in this little farmhouse was called The Miracle of Being Awake, the book that later got retitled The Miracle of Mindfulness. But they didn't use that word mindfulness in the title in that early edition, because I think mindfulness was kind of barely an English word at that point. There was concern that people wouldn't even know what it meant. And it's true, going back to Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, for example, Suzuki Roshi talks about mindfulness in only one talk in the whole book. The title that the editor of the book gave it was called Readiness Mindfulness. And he says that when we're meditating, we just think with our whole mind and see things as they are without any effort. And that this is mindfulness, this readiness of mind. And he says that wisdom is something which comes out of your mindfulness. And I read this chapter again last night, and honestly, it's a very nice chapter. But still, mindfulness doesn't seem very central to Zen Mind Beginner's Mind. And in fact, I was sort of surprised to find it there at all. I hadn't even remembered this one talk in the book that mentions it. And so in a way, Thich Nhat Hanh's radical idea was to put mindfulness front and center. He quotes some of the old Pali sutras, like the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the sutta on mindfulness of breathing, where mindfulness is more of a focus. And this is a bit unusual for a Zen master, a Mahayana Buddhist. But these distinctions between the Theravadan school and the Mahayana school were less emphasized in Vietnam. If you look at a map of where Vietnam sits, it literally is at the intersection of these two movements of Buddhism. To the north, you have China, which is really the great sort of fountain of Mahayana Buddhism. But then to the west, you have Cambodia, Laos, Burma, Thailand, the heartland of Theravadan Buddhism. And so monks from both traditions made their way to Vietnam. And it's clear that Thich Nhat Hanh studied both traditions during his training. And so while maybe this focus on mindfulness seems a bit obvious now, it wasn't then. Practitioners of Zen meditation didn't talk about mindfulness that much. Ehe Dogen, the great Zen master who brought Zen from China to Japan, he doesn't really talk about mindfulness as far as I can tell. He talks about meditation, and he talks about awakening. In some ways, he's a little vague about how one leads to the other, or if one even leads to the other, or if those are even two different things. Thich Nhat Hanh taught that mindfulness is sort of the link between meditation and awakening. Meditation, the sort of practice that we did this morning, it allows us to develop, to cultivate mindfulness. And by cultivating mindfulness, that allows us to realize awakening. It literally wakes us up. And this insight, this sort of explanation for how meditation and awakening might be connected, I think has helped bridge Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism here in the West. This concept of mindfulness has become a bridge between Vipassana practice and Zen meditation. And it sort of helped explain lots of other Zen practices we do, like the service we did this morning, or this formal way of eating meals in the Zendo or Yoki that our founding teacher Koban introduced. All these forms, all these rituals, even these robes, they help us practice mindfulness. And in that way, they're just another form of meditation. And they too help us find awakening. Thich Nhat Hanh's advice to Westerners, particularly at the beginning, was very gentle. There's one line in The Miracle of Mindfulness If you feel at all tired while practicing, stop at once. As I said, I was reading this during a session, an intensive meditation, and I was tired all the time. And so this was a little confusing. We were getting up at, 4 or 5 in the morning, sitting for long hours. And so clearly this advice from Thich Nhat Hanh was a bit at odds with what I was learning from other Zen masters. The practice at the Zen Center of Los Angeles was not particularly gentle. The practice at Tassajara, other Zen monasteries, is not particularly gentle. Our practice here is a bit more gentle, but even here we still get up early and sometimes sit long hours in sesshin. And so for me, as much as I really enjoyed A Miracle of Mindfulness, something about this extreme gentleness sort of turned me off. I felt somehow I wanted more in my practice than slow walks or careful dishwashing. Eventually, Thich Nhat Hanh began to reintroduce more traditional practice to his Sangha. He began offering full ordination to some of his students, the same way that he was ordained when he was young. And in Vietnam, full ordination meant between 200 and 300 precepts. It meant celibacy. It meant giving up all belongings. And when he began reintroducing this, this caused a bit of a shock in his community. And in some ways caused a bit of a schism, because suddenly there seemed to be a hierarchy of practitioners, with these monks and nuns who had taken the full 200 or 300 vows at the top, and the lay people who, you know, in many cases had been following him for decades below. And honestly, this was also a bit of a turnoff to me. It felt like surely there had to be something in between this extremely traditional monastic practice and this extremely open lay practice. But for Thich Nhat Hanh, there wasn't really anything in between. And I think this sort of mirrored the village life that he had grown up with in Vietnam, where you could be a peasant or you could be a monastic. And both were noble paths. He had, of course, been raised as a peasant, as a villager. And there was nothing wrong with living that life. But the two paths were different. He welcomed both, but he really kept the lines between them very clear. And I think this is one part of his legacy that we've resisted in Zen. We have both lay people and priests, but the line between them is much more blurry. Lay people can become teachers without becoming priests. Priests like myself can marry, have children, hold jobs. Some lay people wear robes, much like I'm wearing, and some priests don't. And somehow I really like this messy middle that we've created in American Zen. For me, Buddha's way is all about this messy middle. But for Thich Nhat Hanh, it was not. And I think Thich Nhat Hanh was okay with there being many different approaches to Zen and Buddhism in the West. I don't think he ever came to Jokoji, or at least I haven't heard of him coming. But he visited the San Francisco Zen Center in the 1980s during quite difficult times there. And the reports are that he liked it. He liked what he saw. He appreciated the practice. And some Zen Center students decided to join him in France and practice with him. Arnie Cutler, the student who founded Parallax Press that published Thich Nhat Hanh's books in the early days, had been a Zen Center student. And some students even asked Thich Nhat Hanh if he would consider becoming abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center when Baker Roshi, the successor to Suzuki, left. And it's interesting to imagine what might have happened if he had said yes. But I think he understood that despite a lot of common ground in our practices, that the practices were different and that that was okay, that both lineages should be free to blossom. So I think in some ways, Thich Nhat Hanh was both more radical and more conservative than our own Zen teachers like Koban. He was more radical in his embrace of political action and social engagement, but he was more conservative in his resistance to challenging traditional hierarchy. The equality of men and women, of the laity and the ordained, that somehow was a bit too much for him. In a funny way, perhaps he was outwardly radical and inwardly conservative. Radical toward the outer world, conservative toward the inner Sangha. So I found myself thinking yesterday about how we here at our own Zen temple can best honor Thich Nhat Hanh's great legacy. And I found a talk that he gave at the Berkeley Zendo in 1983, where his advice to the Zen students there was, when you sit down for meditation, your chief business is to become awake. The primary task is to keep yourself awake, to do everything in order to be awake. And so I think despite our differences, we honor Thich Nhat Hanh best by continuing to practice, by sitting every day, by developing mindfulness in everything we do, by paying attention, by waking up. Thank you. We have a few minutes for questions, if there's any questions in the Zendo or online. Yes, Hogan.
Yeah, thanks very much, Dan. One of the phrases, or one of the things that caught my ear was, I think you were speaking of Thich Nhat Hanh's instructions for sitting, and something that came through was something like, engage your whole mind in order to see things as they are. My own experience is, I guess I need more subtle instruction about what it means to engage my whole mind. I feel like there, when I hear that, I think of the kind of focus that's for me habitually egoically driven. I am going to do this now. I am going to make some effort now. It's, can you help me with some some subtlety that has to do with exerting, having this intent and effort without, for me, what I often get is this contraction, a contraction of my being, an egoically driven goal that I'm doing. And I think for me, that when that happens, it sort of gets in the way of really being aware of things as they actually are, because I'm consumed with what am I going to achieve now by doing this thing. So can you help me there?
For me, this question of effort is a challenging one, because I think it's very clear that our practice does require effort. You know, without effort, we would stay in bed. We would not come to temples like Jokoji. We wouldn't sit zazen in what for many of us is a somewhat uncomfortable position for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and sometimes many, many periods. And if you read the old sutras, the old lectures from the Buddha, there are many lectures where he tells his students to make more effort, that they're not trying hard enough, that they're just kind of laying around. Mm-hmm. And he wants them to try harder. Emphasizes that our time is limited. You see that in Dogen and the other Chinese and Japanese Zen masters as well, this sense that, you know, this is your chance right now. And kind of don't waste it, don't blow it. At the same time, I very much know what you mean, that this effort sometimes can feel like it's feeding our egos, mm-hmm. that it feels like just another race that we're trying to win, or just another, I don't know, thing that we're trying to acquire. The Tibetan master, Drungpa Rinpoche, has a whole book on spiritual materialism, basically this kind of acquisitive approach to spiritual practice that he thought was so damaging. You know, my own sense, and it's not, I think, a particularly satisfying answer, is that like everything in our practice, it involves trying to find this balance, this middle way. That our practice requires effort, but sort of not too much effort. And that when we feel that effort kind of veering into kind of competition, that we sort of step back. I think there's nothing wrong with feeling driven to practice. Buddha himself was very driven, you know, had this goal of ending suffering. It was a very, very clear goal for him. And yet when he actually experienced awakening, it was by just sitting under a tree and just sitting there, I think, with no fixed expectation of what would happen. And that's really our practice. You know, that's what we're applying that effort to, is to just sit and not expect or try to force anything in particular to happen during that sitting, but to just be present for whatever arises. And so we're exerting that presence, we're exerting that effort toward presence, towards mindfulness, really. Mm-hmm. And allowing whatever arises in each moment to just arise.
Thank you. I could just comment. One of the things that was very helpful is you mentioned the reminder that we only have a limited time. You know, in this particular awareness has a limited amount of time with which to navigate the world. And so a kind of a koan arose simultaneously. There's only a limited amount of time, and patience is extremely important. And to hold both of those things simultaneously as I sit and be still and be awake for whatever arises, receive it with a kind of gentle acceptance and love. And at the same time, hold that time is limited. So put the effort in now. And patience is love also. Patience will keep me open. So thank you.
You're welcome. Other questions or comments? Yes, online.
Go yeah. Ahead. Okay. That was my brief or limited exposure to Thich Nhat Hanh was just sort of seeing how his influence just kind of moved beyond American Buddhist practice into other areas. And the experience I had was I've been involved with a Methodist church sort of supporting their Empty Bowls Project, which is a thing to support what they call food closets and this and that. And afterwards doing that, I remember receiving a thank you note they sent out to all these people. And on the very front was this quote by Thich Nhat Hanh from this Methodist church in the valley here, which just kind of blew my mind. And it was about compassion and taking care of each other. And he had a way, I think, of putting things that could resonate beyond Buddhist, beyond, you know, feeling that it was contained within a Buddhist doctrine or dogma or something like that. It just felt expansive just reading that. And that same quote could have come from a very compassionate Christian too, but they, Thich Nhat Hanh, and I actually ended up calling the guy. I said, well, how'd you get that? And what? And he says, well, when we see something that's good, we respond to it. And, you know, he had been exposed to some of the writings of Thich Nhat Hanh, and he brought it into his, this whole thing about empty bowls and food closets and all that. So, I just feel somehow in a strange way, just kind of his death just touched me in a real different way. I didn't feel that before he died. So I don't know what's going on, but something's happened. So thanks.
Thank you. I think it's certainly true. I mean, I think he's probably was the second most well-known famous Buddhist teacher after His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And only the Dalai Lama really approaches the kind of universal impact as you mentioned, that Thich Nhat Hanh managed to have. And you do see a few spiritual teachers, spiritual leaders in other traditions who similarly seem to transcend their particular religion or sect. Reverend Martin Luther King is an obvious example, who obviously is quoted far outside his particular sect of Christianity. Desmond Tutu, who passed away recently as well. You know, probably many more people know who he is than know actually which denomination he was a bishop of, because his appeal was so much wider. But there aren't many. I mean, it's a pretty small set of people that seem to be able to transcend their own spiritual tradition and teach in a way that feels so universal. And as I said, to me, one of the, I don't know, the paradoxes of Thich Nhat Hanh is that there were these sort of two sides to his spiritual life. On the one hand, an extremely open and universal teaching that, you know, virtually anyone could follow. And then on the other hand, an extremely traditional, what I think he referred to as the Unified Buddhist Church, Unified Vietnamese Buddhist Church, that was in many respects very conservative. And he clearly felt that both were important, that it was important to continue this rigorous discipline that he had been trained in, but also to open his teachings, you know, literally to everyone, regardless of how they chose to practice. Yes, please.
Hi, Dan. I'm Karin. I'm really, really glad I joined your talk today. Because like Randy, I felt a real need when I learned that Thich Nhat Hanh had passed, that I just wanted to, it really feels good to be able to have this be our focus today. And I appreciate your stories about, you know, his intersection with the West culture and how personal he is for my own life. But I was remembering when you were talking about the story about the kind of trouble within his community at Plum Village when he started to offer ordination. It reminded me of the story that Angie Boisevan, our teacher, shared with us. Apparently she visited Plum Village over the Christmas holiday, and they had a New Year's Eve gathering where they were up and together as the group way late in the evening. And usually the men and the women were very separate in their practice and just in the monastery. But Thich Nhat Hanh kind of was pushing them a little bit. Since there were these Americans visiting, he had requested that at midnight, there was going to be a hug, and everybody was going to hug each other. Men and women were going to hug each other. And he warned them ahead of time so that they all could get it in their, and then you have to hear Andy tell it. It's such a great story. And she was there for this, you know, New Year's Eve hug when the men and the women embraced right at the stroke of midnight. And everybody did it because he requested, but apparently that caused a bit of a commotion afterwards. Like, I can't believe. So I think he was pushing outside of the traditions, even in his own culture and monastery. But anyway, thank you so much for your talk today.
Thanks for sharing. Any other questions or comments before we wrap up?
So, something.
Please.
So I came across first time in my life, I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago with, I don't know where, but it was a contract that Thich Nhat Hanh had got together for whenever basically anger arises that you would sign between your wife and or whatever. And I don't have a wife, but I have a woman friend. And so I copied that. And, and you know, we both signed it, dated it. So it's been quite helpful because every once in a while I have to bring it out. But anyway, I like that. It's
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.